I'm John Kroll. Today, in this special No Limits, we will talk with Paul Farmer and Todd McCormick of Partners in Health, live from the campus of Franklin College. Because we are away from our studio today, we won't be able to take your phone calls, but you can join the conversation by emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Now, this news. Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special No Limits. We are broadcasting live from the campus of Franklin College, where we're going to be talking with Dr. Paul Farmer and Todd McCormick, founding members of Partners in Health. Because we are away from our studio, we're not going to be able to take phone calls, but you can join the conversation by emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, Paul and Todd, welcome back to Indiana.
Thank you.
It's great to be here.
It's good to have both of you here. And I should start this conversation by doing a small disclosure. Paul and Todd are old friends of my wife's from their college days at Duke University. I think that they're learning to tolerate me. But I wanted to get that out there so that no one in the audience thinks we're withholding anything. I wanted to start by talking a little bit about, we're going to talk about the arc of Partners in Health and how it has become what it is, but we should talk a bit about what it is now, what the mission of the organization is. I'll start with you, Paul.
Well, you know, we've sort of stumbled on, I think, getting the mission right, because it's endured for 30 years plus. And it sounds rather arcane, but it's to make a preferential option for the poor in health care, because we knew that a lot of pathogens and pathogenic forces make a preferential option to the poor, rendering them sick. But one thing that we could and should do was try and improve the quality of health services available to people who were critically ill or injured. And we just started when we were students, and now we're working in a dozen countries. Haiti, and Rwanda are the places where we have the largest staff, but we also work in Malawi, Lesotho, Sierra Leone, Liberia, the United States, particularly with the Navajo Nation. And we've worked a lot in Siberia in prisons, and we work in Peru and Chiapas, the southernmost state of Mexico, and there are about 18,000 people working together. Most of them have never had a formal job before and are community health workers, but there are many places where we're the largest employers of physicians, nurses.
How do you settle on the places where you're going to get involved? I mean, some of it is that you run to where the fire is, right? Is that?
Well, I mean, I'm going to pass this over to Todd in a second, but I want to maintain a certain amount of dignity and not make it sound chaotic. But for the first 10 years, it really was haphazard, in the sense of, after we graduated, I was lucky enough to end up in rural Haiti. That's still the same place where we work. And then friends went to Chiapas, and one of our close friends and a founder of Partners in Health, in fact, went to Peru. And there we stumbled across a major epidemic of drug-resistant tuberculosis, which, even though we were trying to ignore it in the slums of Lima, took the life of our friend, the American. And then I had finished my clinical training and was a young medical professor, And that became my area of interest in, you know, drug-resistant tuberculosis, and that's what led us to Russia. So there's a logic there, but it wasn't until we began working in Africa.
Well, and I did not mean to be derogatory by saying running to where the fire is.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah.
And we did that more in our work in Africa. So that's how we end up in Lesotho, which is the highest burden of HIV and TB, and Rwanda, a place after the genocide where it looked like there was going to be real political commitment to extend health services to rural areas, and Malawi, again, because of the burden of disease, and then the West African sites because of Ebola. How did I do, Todd?
Well, I think another key component of looking at our expansion strategy has been making sure that we had a partnership with the government in which we were, the countries in which we were invited to come in. It's not like we chose these countries. There was a lot of discussions. One of the first reasons we went to Africa was we were working very closely at the time with the Clinton Foundation, and I think President Clinton felt like one of the scars on his tenure as president was not responding more proactively to the Rwandan genocide. And so there was a, he had set up conversations with them and said, hey, could you bring the model you developed in Haiti here to Rwanda? And so I think that, you know, we don't really want to provide the a national health system or a workaround to the national health system. What we really want to do is show what's possible and then accompany the government to rebuild their own health systems.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Nate. And again, if you want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what Nate has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Nate writes, my wife is a huge fan of PIH, Partners in Health, and graduates from IU Med School this year. She wanted to ask, what are major barriers to providing global mental health, and what can providers do to help? Paul?
Well, you know, if you look at the burden of disease, you know, mental health always comes in number one, as the number one cause of suffering in the world today. It's also a very significant cause of death, that varies from place to place. So to respond, you need staff, stuff, space, and systems. You need, the question is, who should the staff be? If we wait for psychiatrists, there to be enough psychiatrists, we haven't even managed to cover, you know, urban areas of the United States, at least poor ones, with psychiatrists. You have to think about who the staff should be, and community health workers, nurses specialized in this arena, social workers, have a very key role to play. So human resources is a huge problem. The stuff, well, many, if not most of the ailments we're talking about are amenable to therapy, and it varies, various kinds of therapy, drug therapy, and there are behavioral modification therapies, et cetera. So that's the stuff, right? And sometimes it's stuff delivered by staff without the help of drugs, but often it requires medications. And the space, well, that's open to debate, right? I mean, for someone who is psychotic and extruded from his or her family, they need a safe space, right? And the word asylum didn't used to be a dirty word, right? I mean, it was a place to protect the vulnerable as well. And in the places where we work, these are really terrible settings that need a lot of attention. So that's another area. And then systems. Is there a way to move between, for most people who have mental illness, they don't need to be in a hospital. But what's the connection between the household or the workplace and the places where therapy is developed? That's a ranking problem. And again, community health workers could serve that vital link. It's a long agenda for someone who's graduating, so wow, we're counting on her.
Although some of that, and it serves as a nice setup, you talked about the fact that Partners in Health has been around now for more than 30 years. And I should say it was the growth of the organization was the subject of the Tracy Kidder book, Mountains Beyond Mountains. And also there's a new documentary called Bending the Arc that may be released soon that tells the story. One of the things that struck me when I was watching Bending the Arc and rereading the Kidder book is how young you all were. You talk about now.
Still are.
Well, all right. It's a non-visual medium. You might get away with that one.
Still feel?
Yeah. So it struck me, though, that now, obviously, Partners in Health is this organization that in many ways spans the globe and works with governments. That wasn't the case at the beginning. It was almost like a Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland kind of thing, only instead of putting on a show, it was how can we save lives and save the world. Could you talk a little bit about, what first drew you to the work, why you decided this was important and a priority for you? I'll start with Todd on that one.
I'll be honest. What first drew me to the work was my friendship with Paul. I mean, he's the one that started opening my eyes to some of the issues and challenges that were going on beyond the Ivy Towers at Duke University. And I think well before there was any issues as related to Partners in Health or forming a nonprofit, Paul would make trips to Haiti. In fact, the first time he solicited money from me was actually to plant trees. He said, he had read about the country. Before he went there, he knew it was deforested. He loves agriculture, horticulture, and especially tropical.
My friends call it hoarded torture. I don't know if hoarded torture, Todd calls it.
He said, look, for 10 cents, I can plant a tree. And I thought, okay, I can spare a few beers. A dollar for 10 trees sounds like a good trade. And, gave him 10 bucks or something. So I think that from simple things of starting to learn about Haiti, the community, the challenges, Paul was doing this work and engaged with the people in Haiti, and because of my friendship with him, I became more aware of these issues and felt like this was something that we needed to work on, both as just two individuals initially, and then later we realized, hey, we have an opportunity here. When we met in Boston 3 or 4 years after we both had graduated, when he met Jim Kim and Ophelia Dahl and Tom White, we realized here was an opportunity now to take some of the early work that he had done with the LaFontaine family in Haiti and to start raising money more formally from other people and sharing the work.
Paul.
Well, I one of the things that I wouldn't have said in those first years, and I'm a medical professor now and have been for a long time, so I'm very reluctant to criticize students when they do what I did, which was to exaggerate the significance of our work, right? So, I don't like saying it because it's painful to reflect on, but the first 10 years, of our work were not very good, probably more like slapstick or vaudeville, because, again, you do have to have staff, stuff, space, and systems. Now, we tried hard. We worked hard. Our Haitian colleagues worked hard, but it takes... We made a lot of mistakes, and one of the things we do, and one of the reasons we're here at Franklin College, is because we would like other people not to make those mistakes, to share from our mistakes, so that the people who are the vulnerable and the beneficiary of these services are spared our errors.
What were some of the youthful mistakes?
Well, you can't really have a proper clinic if there's not a laboratory, a pharmacist, if it's a single doctor with a stethoscope and no diagnostics. Can you do more good than harm? Probably, but the alternative is also possible. So it was more Mickey Mouse than Mickey Rooney, if you know what I mean. So we needed to grow very substantially, and we still need to grow, I believe.
We've gotten another email from a listener named Jason. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Jason writes, how do you get so much done? How do you balance being a Harvard professor or corporate executive with being an international do-gooder? What is a typical day or week like for you? When do you awake or sleep? Todd, I'll start with you.
I think, you know, to me, the one thing that I've learned is that not to try to compartmentalize too much. I mean, I feel that, you know, before I feel like I'd had my kind of day job that earned income that I could give more money to Partners in Health, and often then I would go to board meetings or converse with Paul and Ophelia and Jim about some of the challenges they were facing. And for me, trying to somehow bring these different worlds together has been an important thing to kind of kept me sane. I think, you know, it's hard to say that we have desires to do one thing and not try to think of everything collectively.
Talking with Dr. Paul Farmer and Todd McCormick of Partners in Health, live from Franklin College today on No Limits. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're broadcasting live from Franklin College today, where we're talking with Dr. Paul Farmer and Todd McCormick, who are co-founders of Partners in Health. Because we are away from our studio, we're not able to take phone calls, but you can join the conversation by emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Paul, I'm going to give you a chance to answer Jason's question that we got right before the break about how you balance all of the responsibilities.
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm reminded how fortunate I am to, I mean, I met Todd on the first day of college, you know, and here he is, saying it's, you know, his job is to integrate his work and his work with Partners in Health, which I think is a wonderful thing. And I have several close college friends who feel that way, which is pretty extraordinary, right? But I would add that if you're in academic medicine, and I kind of knew I was going to go into academic medicine, you know, then you have three jobs: to take care of sick people, to teach, and one hopes to learn, and also to generate new knowledge called research. So, I mean, I'm basically doing my job, whether I'm in Rwanda or Boston, I'm usually doing one of those three things, that or looking for the resources necessary to do them, because in many places we work, there are no staff or space, so you have to recruit and train staff and build the space, right, and buy the stuff. So that's how my, you know, that's an arcane way of saying that's how my day is divided. But to Jason specifically, I would say I get a lot of comfort out of reading and writing. And yes, I watch Game of Thrones. It is true. But, I mean, reading about, you know, I'd never spent any time in West Africa before the Ebola outbreak claimed a friend of mine, a doctor, a Sierra Leonean doctor, had only been there once before he died, and I had friends there, but I'd never read anything about the place, and same for Liberia, and same on and on it goes. So reading and writing is helpful to me in terms of just organizing my time. I know that sounds bizarre, but it makes me more efficient. Efficiency is not something I'm known for, okay? But I think reading and writing, anybody can do that. When I mean writing, some people write in a journal, some people write in a scholarly journal, some people, but just that's how I try to get organized in my mind, is to take the step back that's required for reading and writing.
I think we have a question. Hope Schrum, who is a freshman here at Franklin College, who are we going to be talking with?
Hey, John. This is Tiffany Kreitz from Mooresville, Indiana, and she has a question about Todd and Paul's achievements.
Okay.
So I was just wondering, out of all the work you've done, what has been your proudest accomplishment?
Thanks for the question. Todd, Paul is looking over your direction, so we'll take that as a cue that he wants you to go first.
Exactly. My children, for sure. Yeah, no, I think with PIH, I think it's terrific to have a good idea, to help a family, to help a person, and have that kind of humane response to an issue, but I think it's a challenge to try to build an organization to, you know, the famous word scaling. And I certainly think what is magical about PIH for me is it's a, as its name implies, is a partnership among academic institutions. Paul's never been paid a penny by PIH to do the work. It's not like he runs a nonprofit. He's, as he said, an academic professor at Harvard. And it's the research and teaching that has built a system underneath that now. So now there's a Department of Social, Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. They're now endowed professors underneath Paul that will continue to carry on that academic work. And the same thing is when you see having sister organizations, as our mission statement says, we now have, you know, of the 18,000 people, 99.9% of these are people living in countries working and doing the work, and they're training the next generation of Haitian or Liberian physicians and nurses. And so for me, helping to try to build, I think, in my view, you know, why Paul is an amazing individual in terms of what he's done, far more amazing and is the system that he's built. And I think the Board of Partners in Health and so many other people that are on the leadership team have helped try to build up that system to scale the work and have it long endure, each of us and the other founders of the organization.
Well, I mean, thank you, Todd. And we don't always talk to each other like this, but it's like, no, Todd, I said that. But thank you. You know, to give an example of Todd's point and then choose something pretty extraordinary, after the earthquake in Haiti, you know, we'd been working there for so long. It was easily the low point of my life. You know, we lost a lot of our coworkers and friends, right? And the majority of the destruction was in the capital city. So that meant that the teaching hospitals, such as they were damaged or destroyed. And there weren't that many federal buildings in Haiti, but I think 28 out of 29 of them collapsed, or, you know, so, and some of them were quite old, right? So that seemed to be a time where Partners in Health, well, of course we went and took care of injured people. I mean, that's what the clinicians did, and that's what I did. But I was pretty proud when we built with the government, which had been so badly weakened, right? 20% of the Ministry of Health employees in the city were killed or maimed in some way. I mean, it's just an astounding figure. But we built a university hospital in the middle of central Haiti, the same place where I had gone in 1983. That's not why we built it there. It was outside of the earthquake zone. We built it to, you know, California earthquake specifications. It's the largest solar-powered hospital probably in the developing world. But the point that Todd's making is that it is also a key training site for Haitian nurses, doctors, health managers. It's the first emergency medicine residency program in Haiti's history. I think all the first set of graduates were women. There's a surgical residency, pediatrics residency, even a nascent psychiatry residency. And, you know, and it's a public hospital. Because as Todd said, we want, when we can, to work with the public sector because that's the only institution that can confer any kind of right to health care. And I can't not mention my pride in Partners in Health when the board said, yes, you can go join the Ebola response. And also, when Todd mentioned the term scale, you know, I think of dermatology myself, but everybody's obsessed with scaling something, and I understand that. But, you know, one of the ways we do that is through universities. And so we launched our own with the Rwandans. And on January 25th, we just opened the new campus in northern Rwanda, and it is beautiful. I mean, anybody should go online and look at the pictures. And it's led by Dr. Agnes Benaguahu, the pediatrician who you mentioned you saw bending the arc. She's the head of it, and the dean is an Ethiopian thoracic surgeon. I mean, these are world-class leaders. And the first med school class is going to start soon. And there, I'm not, you know, I don't make decisions. I'm a founder, but and a professor there. But they're aiming for 70% girls or women in the first med school class. So when it's when we say University of Global Health Equity, you know, you could say PIHU too. I mean, we're all very proud of that and have high hopes because we believe that the next generation is going to do a better job than we did.
If you're just joining us, we are broadcasting live from Franklin College, where we're talking with Dr. Paul Farmer and Todd McCormick. They are two of the five founders of Partners in Health. Because we're away from our studio, we're not able to take calls today, but you can join the conversation by emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Got a question from a listener on via Twitter who says, China is building a national health care system. Millions of rural residents now have health insurance. What are your thoughts about the development of universal health care in the developing countries? How hopeful are you about the health care in the U.S. becoming more affordable? Paul?
China, had built up a rural health care system and then let it really collapse. And the cost of that was enormous. I'm not an expert on the field, but certainly work with many who are, including colleagues from China. So that withdrawal, whether you call it neoliberal or whatever, was very costly in terms of by any valuation. Ours tend to be human health and well-being. So we have nothing but enthusiasm for national health systems that provide a safety net for everyone. And to me, if you think about what's the destination, you can't say, well, we got to deal with Ebola or AIDS or whatever, because what the pathologies are will change over time with the tools available to counter them. They'll change over time. The goal is universal health care. Where everyone has this safety net. So there are lots of lessons that the United States can learn. I'll just take Rwanda as an example because I've never worked in China. I've only visited. And the national safety net, is based on a very large number of 50,000 community health workers, and this is a fairly compact country, about 11 million people, linked to nurse-led clinics. Again, these are all public facilities. There are also private facilities. I haven't worked in them, right? And then what are called district hospitals. It sounds like jargon to an American, but that would be your county or a public hospital. That system is connected one layer after the other, so you can work on prevention with the community health workers and take care of minor problems in a clinic, and then for the sick, that's when they go to the hospital. And since that system has been put in place, since the genocide against the Tutsi, Rwanda has seen the most dramatic declines in mortality ever registered at any place, at any point in human history, and in any place. So there's a reason why, and it's not just prevention, it's integrating preventive efforts, meaning get everyone vaccinated, kids, babies and kids vaccinated, et cetera, et cetera, and then linking it to a healthcare system that focuses on the bottom quintile. That's what they call it. We say preferential option for the poor. Economists say bottom quintile. We don't care how you say it. It's that the people who were excluded are not excluded anymore. And of course, they were making a bet that if they could extend such services along with education to the nation, that they would avoid the kind of catastrophic conflagration that they had in 1994. And so far they have.
I want to come back to the growth of the organization. I think what Todd referred to is scaling. Because one of the things that struck me, again, as I was looking at the story, is you started and it was really this small and intimate effort, and at least part of, you know, the implied mission was that, you know, healthcare is an incredibly personal thing, that we have to value every human being, and that therefore, you know, the connections between the people who are providing the care, the people who are receiving it are incredibly important. What's happened is Partners in Health has grown then from being basically just a handful of people to having thousands of people all over the world, either who are working for the organization or are in partnership with it in some ways. And I think one of the remarkable things that you've done is that you haven't surrendered that intimacy of the experience. How did you do that? I'll start with Todd on that.
Well, you know, I think for my own, speaking personally, I have an immense amount of respect not only for Paul, but also for Ophelia and Jim. Obviously, Tom White and myself, I think, brought different types of experiences to the program, but these people live the experience, and I would say, I think both Tom and I would say are the soul of the mission, if you will. And I think trying to, you know, we're very lucky that Ophelia is still chairing the board of directors. Paul continues to provide strategic counseling and continues to chair the board of trustees. So their voices are very present. And many of us, just like I did at the Duke campus, want to get involved to continue to better understand the challenges and keeping that. And I think people, you know, see our mission as precious and want to maintain it as we do that. And I think there are obviously some tensions sometimes when that comes on in discussions of how you reflect that mission in the strategic decisions the organization takes. But I think that I don't think there's any question that the directors and the people who govern are stewarding the mission, you know, share that value with me.
Well, I guess, Todd, to follow up with you just a little bit here, since you did come from a business and educational background to this, you know, in terms of setting up the structure, how important was it to you to maintain a system in which that kind of intimacy of the experience was still kept centermost?
Well, I think it was vital. And I think, you know, another part, I think so often you have these general structures of corporations that I've kind of grown up in, or even schools with a headmaster and a head of a middle school and a teacher. You know, we get socialized in thinking certain ways. And I think what's so unique about PIH is it's set up more as a confederation of sister organizations. So I think, as Paul has said many, many times, his greatest teacher is Haiti. And I think our executive leadership tries the best to listen to our sister organizations and what can we do to accompany them on their mission, as opposed to trying to dictate some policies to them. So I think the very nature of how the organization has been set up and recognizing that has been part of what we work so hard to protect.
Paul, your thoughts? Well, you've got about a minute.
I never answer things in a minute, but I thought that was awesome. You know, the intimacy, we insist on our own friendships, you know, Ophelia, Jim, Todd, Tom has passed away. But inside a team working on behalf of, you know, like I was just in, you know, in Liberia. And the Liberian team, by the way, is headed by a Haitian protege of ours. But they have that intimacy with their Liberian colleagues because they're working together side by side to take care of people, to solve problems. So, you know, that sister organization, that horizontal posture is the key to maintaining intimacy, because it's about respect and solidarity.
Is there a system that you use to train people who are coming on, or are those the sort of people that PIH attracts?
Well, I mean, a lot of them have been students, and a lot of us are teachers. And you know, my Haitian colleagues are teaching in Haiti, you know, and Rwanda. We started, you know, they started a university. So the onboarding, as they say, it's always good, I think, for Americans to spend some time in a place that would be very different. Well, they're all different. Like, Russia is very different from the United States. But, you know, to go to rural Malawi is a life-changing experience for some of our leadership, and it's been great.
Farmer and Todd McCormick of Partners in Health, live from the campus of Franklin College today on No Limits. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today live from the campus of Franklin College with two of the founders of Partners in Health, Dr. Paul Farmer and Todd McCormick. Because we are away from our studio, we're not able to take phone calls today, but we are inviting you to join the conversation by emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at wfyi. We have an email from a listener named Pat, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Pat writes, I've heard of Partners in Health when employed by Regan Streiff Institute here in Indianapolis and sat next to the Open MRS group. Through formal and informal meetings, I've had a glimpse into some of the differences between non-U.S. healthcare and here. I'm curious if you had to unlearn any of your medical education to better work with the various other cultures you've encountered. I'm assuming that's you, Paul.
Well, yeah, I'm actually a physician anthropologist, so I'll take that on. Can I say something about Open MRS in Indianapolis? So Open MRS, you know, the idea behind it was to develop an electronic medical record for places like rural Haiti and, you know, rural Malawi, where there wasn't electricity and an internet connection. But I mean, if there's not an electricity and an internet connection, get electricity and get an internet connection. And that spun into, that was years of hard work by, you know, programmers and from all over. Partners in Health spearheaded that for a decade, and it spun off into Open MRS, and I think it's used in like 50 countries. So, and, you know, things to unlearn. It's not about pathophysiology, like how the body works, but, you know, it's, in fact, that I think is an important thing to remember, is that if you're sick with, you know, leukemia in Malawi or sick with leukemia in Indiana, it's probably, you know, you're going to need the, depending on what kind of leukemia, it's probably going to need the same medications, but one place has them and the other does not. And, you know, our longest corporate partnership at Partners Health has been with Lilly, you know, which is headquartered in Indianapolis, 20-something years, because they had something we needed. And we also had the audacity to ask them to give it to us and to pay for other people to learn to make it, which they did, right? And that really also comes out of accompaniment, right? In this case, we felt they were accompanying us, we were accompanying them. The connection there is, again, really about redistributing and financing healthcare for poor people. And I never learned anything about it in medical school. I didn't even know how, you know, what was the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. You know, it's kind of shameful, right, if you have an MD and a PhD and you don't know how your training, the next years of your training are going to be financed. I didn't. And the answer is Medicare, by the way, largely. So there's a lot of things that we had to learn that we never were taught and in medical school. You know, by the time I started medical school, it was obviously about teamwork, right? You don't get anything done if you're not working with nurses, social workers, patients, and their families, right? But again, I learned the stuff about community health workers. I learned that in Haiti first and then Rwanda. So I had to unlearn, in a sense, the idea that we could treat chronic illness effectively in the United States without the help of community health workers. That's a kind of unlearning. You know, but how the lungs work, you know, they work, you know, they work, if they work differently in South Africa, it's because you're in a mine and breathing in, you know, some dreadful dust or something. But basically the human body, you know, is the same, and it's the equity problem, the social issues that are different. And I think everybody in my field ought to know a lot more about how we can finance better healthcare for people who are outside of that safety net.
One of the things that struck me in the documentary, Bending the Arc, was the moment, and you alluded to him earlier, your friend Father Jack when he died, and you said in the documentary that, you know, as much as people would like to say we were quick to respond to something, there's always this delay that in which we say, is this my responsibility? And that delay is often fatal, that it was for him. Have you gotten to a point in your life where you don't ask yourself that question anymore? In terms of the organization, whether, you know, you've gotten better at sort of short-circuiting that natural question.
You know, I think that it's as important a question then as when Father Jack died. After all, he wasn't the first person to acquire multidrug-resistant tuberculosis in that squatter settlement in Lima, Peru. He was an American and a friend of ours and a founder of Partners in Health. But we knew there were other cases, you know, and that's what led us to Lilly, by the way, because they had two of the drugs that we needed, and they're only people who made them still. And we should have done all that stuff earlier. Now, you know, jump ahead to every other pathology we're seeing. I still think we were too slow to have an equity platform at the heart of this, right? So if there's a new development, a new cancer chemotherapeutic agent, oral, let's say, and we don't have a plan for getting that, then we're going to see kids, adults die of, you know, leukemia. And if there's a new treatment for hepatitis C, et cetera, et cetera. So I think one of the things that we'd like to do with the help of the University of Global Health Equity is actually study that delay and see how we can shorten it and others can shorten it. That we have, when there's a new discovery, that usually comes from basic science, by the way, that we have a plan for delivering it to people who are left out. So an equity plan up front. And we're getting better, but I don't think we should be bragging about it yet.
Todd?
I think this same pathology creeps into the organizational behavior of a bureaucracy all the time. So I think we, you know, before there was really an informal board of Paul, Jim, and Ophelia, and periodically they might ask my opinion or say, Tom, do you think this is a good idea? But there was an ability to be quite quick on your feet. Now we've got, you know, governance committees and lawyers and accountants and procedures and other board members to, you know, approve. And a lot of these checks and balance systems have allowed what PIH to grow and scale, but at the same time they have trade-offs in the delay, because you know, if you feel like, okay, we're definitely going to raise the money for this, well, maybe we shouldn't start building right now until we have all the operational costs covered for the first year. I mean, so these are the kind of things that we struggle with, I would think, probably more now than we did at that time.
Has that been the biggest challenge, is figuring out how to manage that kind of growth? Because there was, in the early years, a certain improvisational quality, and it's sort of like the difference between trying to turn a rowboat into a battleship. You need more time.
Well, you know, I think if the mission is as good as we believe it is, and again, I mentioned stumbled. I feel like we stumbled on it and got it right, thanks to a lot of people in Haiti and Peru, and we hadn't even started working in Peru. But if the mission's right, any romanticism about smallness is a sin. So there, we've got to hurry, you know, we've got to rush. I mean, yeah, there's been overall positive trends in life expectancy and mortality, but, you know, among the bottom billion, things are pretty grim. And so that's the biggest frustration for me, is that the delay, and the anguish and the arguments, not arguments, like mean-spirited arguments, like tough decisions, that is the hardest thing. You know, like, you know, 2 weeks ago in Liberia, seeing patients, I mean, I knew the names of the drugs that they needed, and they, you know, just didn't, we have to get them, right? And, you know, those kind of delays are the ones I was talking about with Father Jack, in a sense. there are policy delays. There, you know, it's the same thing in Haiti. Of course, anyone who comes from Liberia to Indianapolis goes via Haiti, right? You know, it was we built a lab with the first time there's ever been pathologists in central Haiti, three Haitian women actually, all right there in the lab. But that doesn't mean we don't have dilemmas getting some of these samples back quickly, and that costs money. So the biggest frustration for me is the delay. You know, is seeing something, and in my case with my own eyes, but we shouldn't have to see it with our own eyes, seeing something and know that we're just not moving fast enough to save that person's lives or prevent that suffering.
If you're just joining us, we are talking live from the campus of Franklin College with Dr. Paul Farmer and Todd McCormick of Partners in Health. Because we're away from our studio, we're not able to take calls today. You can join the conversation, though, by emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. We have a question here at Franklin College. Victoria Ratliff, you're a freshman here. Who are we going to be talking with?
We are going to talk with Dr. Tong, who is assistant professor of sociology here at Franklin College, and she just wanted to ask about how we can help with social justice.
So what are your suggestions to people who would like to help with social inequality, but they are already overwhelmed by everyday work and they might feel very powerless in terms of what they can do, and they may feel a little disillusioned and a little cynical about what's going on in the world?
I'm going to ask Todd to start. He's as obsessed with this as I am.
You know, I think one of the great challenges that when you think about Partners in Health, and you know, you don't need to look very far to find injustice. I think some Brian Stevenson, one of our dear friends and fellow board members at Partners in Health, you know, once said that, you know, the opposite of poverty is not wealth, it's an injustice. And how do we address those injustices? And I think that, you know, I find, at least in my own hypocrisy, sometimes I'll be walking down the street, seeing something going wrong, or just someone just being rude and not saying something about it. And I think just trying to be honest with ourselves and reactions to what's fair and the spirit of fairness and being able to want to speak up. You don't have to go to Liberia and be, you know, fighting Ebola to work on these types of issues, especially given some of the challenges that we face as Americans today. So to me, that's my quick answer. It's like it's all around you every day, and to speak up and to find fellow friends in the fight.
Paul.
I would, I know we sound like we're echoing each other, but as a fellow professor, you know, I think, you know, even though a lot of what the teaching I do is clinical, I also teach some of the things probably similar to you do, to the things that you teach. And I think that the notion that inequality is some far off thing, as Todd said, is just false, right? Like we have, you know, our country is founded on, you know, two great crimes and, among other things, but I'm saying, you know, there's a reason that we work with the Navajo Nation. There's a reason that we're concerned with structural racism, right? But for a lot of people, they haven't had the chance that you did to, you know, take a doctoral degree in sociology. So teaching right here, you know, about how inequalities get into the body, I think that's a really important thing to do. And you know, I would add, although you probably already know it and many students here would, we call it global health in, you know, as against what it used to be called when I started medical school, which is international health or even overseas health, over what sea particularly, right? So global health means that Indianapolis is on the globe, you know, and Montgomery, where our friend Brian works, on the globe. And it is not meant to do colonial medicine better. It's meant to focus on equity. And I think, you know, as teaching about social inequalities I hope it's not to be undervalued, you know, in addressing the inequalities that are unveiled before us right in our own neighborhoods, backyards, counties, state, whatever.
We're getting close on time toward the end.
Well, journalism, by the way, I think is a big part of that. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I don't want to forget that, you know, we're facing a problem in, you know, that we don't, journalists don't have the resources that they used to have to address many of these pressing social pathologies here or elsewhere. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that we're glad to be on your show, John.
One of the things that strikes me, too, about the work you do is that because you are exposed to tremendous amounts of suffering, could you talk a little bit about how you managed to not to become, you know, insulated against it? Callousness is a kind of personal defense system often, and obviously it, for the kind of work you do, it would be deadly.
I hang around with Todd. I watch Game of Thrones. Because, you know, when the dragons show up, you know it's not going to happen. Like, I could never watch a show like Breaking Bad. It's too much like real life. No offense if anyone was involved in making it here. Well, first of all, good news, I think it's good news, is that I have had, personally, a lot of the people I know, and I'm among them, no erosion, no callousness because of continued and direct proximity. You know, I mentioned Liberia. I have a lousy haircut because some kid, 22-year-old, who looked like he was 10, weighed about 80 pounds, has multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, and I'd been asked to see some patients, but not him, and he came up to me, and he said, well, why don't you see me, doctor? And I was like, okay, is my heart going to break? But I'm not going to let him know that. So, and I've learned not to say, what is it you did? Because it's a two-year, unless we can get these other drugs, he's in for two-year treatment. I said, what do you do? He said he was a barber. So, you know, that was for me because it's so wrenching to see young people dying of stupid diseases, as the Haitians say. And, you know, I think it's not, the answer is not retreat from suffering or averting your gaze. It's engaging with it, and sometimes in obvious ways, and sometimes, you know, just having a talk with a youngster and letting him give you a haircut.
I think that will have to be the last word. I would like to thank my guests, Dr. Paul Farmer and Todd McCormick of Partners in Health. Thank you both. I've enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
And also like to thank all of the folks here at Franklin College as well as our listeners. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.